We've all seen it happen. A shocking crime splashes across the headlines and captures the attention of the nation. The public eagerly awaits any sort of update, a piece of evidence revealed, a new lead, an interesting clue. Eventually, guilt is debated, verdicts are decided, and just as quickly as the media frenzy begins, it ends, and the world moves on. But not in this case. More than 130 years later, we're still talking about the murders of Andrew and Abby Borden, a crime so brutal, so sensational, it became one of the most legendary cases in American history. A story that echoes through generations in books, plays, films, even an eerie nursery rhyme. It's 1892, and the Bordens are a prominent family in Fall River, Massachusetts. 69-year-old Andrew Borden is one of the city's wealthiest men, and notoriously frugal. His wife and two daughters, Emma and Lizzie, are pillars of the community, active in church, charity, and temperance leagues. They're respectable, well-known, even envied. But behind this polished facade, life inside the Borden home is far more complicated. And on the morning of August 4th, 1892, their home would become the scene of one of the most shocking crimes of the century. Andrew Borden was brutally murdered as he napped on his living room sofa. His wife, Abby, was found half an hour later, face down in the guest room upstairs, struck 19 times in the back of the head with a hatchet. The brutality stunned the town of Fall River, but even more shocking was who police accused: Andrew's own daughter, Lizzie Borden. Her arrest ignited a media firestorm and led to one of the most notorious trials in history. Today, the case still fascinates and divides, posing the same haunting question. Did Lizzie Borden get away with murder? The prosecution says she's a cold-blooded killer. The defense says she's a loving daughter, but it's the jurors who have the final say. This is 13th Juror Podcast, where we break down real court cases and put you in the juror's seat. Two sides, the same evidence. You decide what to believe. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell, and today's episode is Massachusetts versus Lizzie Borden, Part 1, the prosecution's case. Let's go back to a time before Lizzie Borden was a household name and focus on the indisputable facts from the courtroom. Despite all the questions that still surround this case, the basic outline of the morning's events was never in doubt. Andrew Borden was just 23 when he married his first wife, Sarah. Together, they had three daughters, Emma, Alice, and Lizzie. Tragedy struck the family early on when 2-year-old Alice died, and soon after, Sarah, too, leaving 12-year-old Emma and 2-year-old Lizzie without their mother. By 1865, just 2 years after Sarah's death, Andrew remarried. His new wife, Abby Gray, entered the household when Lizzie was just a toddler. Abby would spend the next 30 years as stepmother to the Borden girls, managing the home on 2nd Street and trying, in her own way, to keep the family happy. Andrew Borden spent his life working and saving through banking, country farms, and a portfolio of rental properties, he amassed a fortune that today would amount to millions. Despite his wealth, Andrew chose to live simply in a modest house on 2nd Street. The Borden's house, in many ways, mirrored their private lives. It wasn't a grand estate, but a long, narrow duplex originally designed to divide a single residence in two. The layout itself seemed to reinforce the divisions within the family. Lizzie and Emma's rooms were only accessible by the narrow front staircase. Mr. and Mrs. Borden's room, on the other hand, could only be reached through the back staircase. There was no hallway or easy passage between the two ends of the house. The architecture drew an invisible line through the family, the daughters on one side, their father and stepmother on the other. The house also had an odd number of locks, mostly in part because Andrew Borden was obsessively cautious about security. The front door alone had 3 separate locks, and interior rooms were bolted from one another. To outsiders, it looked like vigilance. But on the inside, These locks felt like physical and emotional barriers, keeping the family apart. As one lawyer would later describe it, although they occupied the same household, there was built up between them, by locks and bolts and bars, an impassable wall. The circle inside the house on the morning of the murders was small. Emma was away on a long trip visiting friends, and Lizzie's Uncle John, who had stayed the night, left after breakfast. That left Bridget Sullivan, the Borden's live-in housekeeper, Mr. and Mrs. Borden, and Lizzie. Four people inside the locked house, and by noon, half of them would be dead. The question was simple. Who did it? For the prosecution, the answer was just as easy. Based on the testimony and evidence they presented, this is the prosecution's version of the story. For the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the case stood on two pillars: opportunity and motive. And when it came to who had the opportunity, prosecutors argued the possibilities were narrow because the Borden house was locked. On the morning of August 4th, the Borden's front door was fastened with both a spring lock and a heavy bolt. The side door was shut, the screen door latched, the cellar barred from within. To the prosecution, all of these locks mattered. They weren't just part of the Borden family's daily routine. They were proof that no stranger could have slipped inside, carried out two brutal murders in separate rooms of the house, then vanished into the streets of Fall River without leaving a trace. For prosecutor William Moody, the answer was inescapable. It had to be Lizzie Borden. She was inside, she had the time, she had the opportunity, and he said, she had the motive, because behind those locked doors was a family long divided. The relationship between Lizzie and her stepmother had been strained for years. What began as polite distance had hardened into bitterness. Like so many family dramas, at the heart of the conflict was money and the question of who it belonged to. Andrew's habit of providing for Abby and her extended family didn't sit well with his daughters. Every monetary gesture toward their stepmother's side of the family felt like a betrayal to Lizzie and Emma. Money taken directly from what they considered to be their inheritance. The prosecution argued that Lizzie's frustrations reached a breaking point. She wanted her father's estate secured solely for herself and her sister. And Abby, Andrew's wife and a potential heir, stood in the way. So when the murders occurred, they said it wasn't random. It was personal. Abby was struck down first, 19 blows to the back of her head. Andrew, killed barely an hour later, was left mutilated on the sofa in his sitting room. To prosecutors, the locks on the doors weren't signs of safety. They were a trap, a house sealed from the world outside, with a resentful killer waiting within. Now, all they had to do was prove it. The trial opened on June 5th, 1893. 10 months after the murders. 12 men were chosen as jurors, and because this was a capital case, they were sequestered for the trial's entirety. No newspapers, no outside contact. For weeks, their entire world would be the courtroom. Prosecutor William Moody stood before the jury to deliver his opening statements and wasted no time in telling the jury what they were about to hear. This was not a mystery, he said. It was a case built on circumstances that pointed to only one conclusion. He promised to show that the murders of Andrew and Abby Borden were carried out inside a house sealed tight to the outside world by a woman driven by greed and resentment. And he told the jury to watch closely because Lizzie Borden's behavior before the murders was suspicious, and her behavior afterward, even more so. Being that this was a capital case, the 12 jurors knew the weight of what sat before them. If found guilty, Lizzie Borden could hang. The stakes could not have been higher. As the Commonwealth laid out the case against Lizzie Borden for the jury, they began where the investigation had begun: the house. Prosecutors wanted the jury to see the Borden home not just as a backdrop, but as evidence. The walls, the stairways, the locked doors, all of it mattered. They argued the layout itself illustrated who was able to move about the house freely and who was prevented from moving at all. To hone in on the importance of this, the prosecution's very first witness wasn't a neighbor, doctor, or even a policeman. It was an engineer called to walk the jury through the floor plan of the Second Street house and show why, in their eyes, a stranger couldn't have entered undetected. The house, they said, was the silent witness to these murders. Prosecutors argued the house's unusual layout was critical to understanding the case, and they explained it in great detail. They even took the jury on a formal viewing so they could see it with their own eyes. Unfortunately, we can't take you on a jury view. But if you'd like a visual, there's a great article in the New York Post about the house being sold and turned into a tourist bed and breakfast. There are more than 20 pictures in the article of the home, which had remained close to its original state. The house was described to jurors as a long, narrow rectangle, and every room was shut off from the next. Remember, this was the 1890s, long before open floor plans existed. The top floor was the attic, which also doubled as housekeeper Bridget Sullivan's bedroom. The cellar, which could be reached from both inside and outside, was used mostly for storage. And the first and second floors were the heart of the home. There were two staircases, one in the front and one in the back. The front stairs led directly from the front door to the daughter's bedrooms and the guest room, where Abby's body was found. The back stairs near the kitchen led to Mr. and Mrs. Borden's bedroom and the attic. Here's the strange part. There is no hallway connecting the two sides of the second floor. To move from Lizzie's bedroom on the second floor to her father's, you couldn't simply walk across. You had to go all the way back downstairs, cross through the house, and climb up the other staircase. The peculiar divided layout of the house and all its locked doors were key points in the prosecution's case. Abby's body was found upstairs in the guest room, and Andrew's downstairs in the center of the house. Meaning, the killer couldn't have come from the outside without being spotted by someone already inside. If the house was the stage, the next task was to account for its actors. The prosecution set out to reconstruct the morning of the murders, who was present inside the Borden home, and what role they may have played. The day began like any other Thursday in the Borden household. Around 6:15 a.m., the housekeeper, Bridget, was the first one up, lighting the stove, bringing in milk, and starting her chores. Within minutes, Abby came downstairs, followed by Andrew. He set his bedroom key on the sitting room shelf. He locked his door every time he left it, and stepped out the back door to go to the barn. Like I mentioned at the top of the episode, the Bordens were wealthy, but frugal. Their home still lacked indoor plumbing, so Andrew washed up outside. The back door would later become central to this case. The heavy outer door was left open during the day, but the screen door stayed closed and latched from the inside. And whether it was hooked or left unlatched would matter. Andrew returned to the house with pears he'd gathered from the yard and latched the screen door closed behind him. By the time breakfast was served, Uncle John Morse had joined them. John was actually the brother of Andrew Borden's first wife, Sarah. He'd spent the night in the guest room, had breakfast, and by 9 a.m. was gone. Andrew carried a bowl of water upstairs, Bridget cleared the table, and the household continued in their morning routine. A few minutes later, Lizzie appeared for the first time that morning. She declined a full breakfast, settling for coffee and a few cookies. Bridget, meanwhile, started to feel unwell. The night before, the whole family had complained of stomach sickness, and now it was hitting her too. She slipped out to the yard, fearing she might be sick, and when she came back inside, Lizzie was gone. At this point, Bridget sees Abby, who asked her to wash the windows of the house inside and out. That interaction would mark the last time anyone saw Abby Borden alive. Bridget stepped out with her pail and brush and began scrubbing the windows inside and out, just as Abby had asked. While she worked, Lizzie drifted in and out of sight, sometimes appearing in the back entry, then quickly gone again. Around 10:45 a.m., Andrew returned home from some morning errands. The front door, fastened with three separate locks, was giving him trouble, so Bridget went to let him in. As she did, she heard a laugh come from Lizzie at the top of the stairs. Andrew came in quietly, carrying the mail, and sat down to look it over. Minutes later, Lizzie came down to join him. She asked about mail and told him Abby had received a note and gone out. When Andrew settled in on the sitting room couch, Bridget moved to the dining room to finish up the windows there. Soon after, Lizzie entered the dining room with an ironing board and began pressing handkerchiefs. She chatted with Bridget about a fabric sale and asked if she planned to go out later. Bridget, still feeling ill, said she wasn't sure. Lizzie mentioned that Abby had gone out after receiving a note about someone who was sick and added that she might go out too. She reminded Bridget to lock the door if she did. Bridget was puzzled. Abby hadn't said a word about leaving. And when she asked who was sick, Lizzie said, "I don't know, the note came this morning. It must be in town." Bridget finished her chores and went upstairs to rest, leaving Lizzie alone downstairs with her father. The city hall bell struck 11. Bridget had just settled into her room for an afternoon nap, but hadn't drifted off to sleep when she heard Lizzie yelling up the stairs, "Come down quick. Father's dead. Somebody came in and killed him." Bridget rushed down the stairs at the back of the house as Lizzie stood in the back entry, just inside the screen door. As Bridget moved toward the sitting room, Lizzie stopped her. She told Bridget they need a doctor and asked her to go get Dr. Bowen. Bridget ran across the street to the doctor's house, but he wasn't home. His wife promised to send him over as soon as he returned. As Bridget ran back home, the Borden's neighbor, Mrs. Churchill, saw her rushing, pale-faced, across the yard. Moments later, she spotted Lizzie at the back door, leaning against the frame, visibly upset. Churchill opened her window to ask if she was all right. Lizzie asked her to come over, telling her, "Someone has killed Father." Bridget, still shaken, asked Lizzie, "Didn't I leave the screen door hooked?" Lizzie told her she'd been in the backyard when she heard a groan, and when she came back in, the screen door was standing wide open. She then asked Bridget if she knew where Alice Russell lived. Alice was one of Lizzie's closest friends. She used to live next door, but 3 years before had moved a couple blocks further north. Just hours earlier, Lizzie spent the evening in Alice's sitting room and told her she had a terrible feeling something was going to happen. We know the whole Borden household, Andrew, Abby, and Lizzie, had been sick the night before. Only Bridget had escaped it, but by morning, she was sick too. Alice asked if it was something they ate, and Lizzie said she thought maybe their milk had been poisoned. But then Lizzie said something else, something prosecutors later argued was an attempt to plant a cover story. She told Alice she was afraid her father had enemies and that men came to see him and often left angry. She mentioned one man in particular, angry over a rental dispute, who Andrew had ordered out of the house. She said she had seen a stranger lurking outside at night. The barn had been broken into twice, and that the house had been burglarized in broad daylight, her stepmother's room ransacked. When Alice asked why she hadn't heard about it, Lizzie said that their father forbade them from speaking of it. Lizzie said she was worried that someone would do something to her father because of how discourteous he was to people, and gave an example of his harsh treatment toward Dr. Bowen when Abby consulted him about the family's illness. Lizzie explained that her father had scolded Dr. Bowen for making what he saw as an unnecessary visit. Then he snapped at Abby, telling her that his money wouldn't pay for the unneeded treatment. To Lizzie, it was another example of her father's controlling, dismissive nature, a trait she worried would cause retaliation if he angered the wrong person. That evening, Lizzie confided to Alice that she had an uneasy sense that something terrible was going to happen. By the next morning, she was sending Bridget to find Alice because that something had just happened. As Bridget scrambled to find Alice and Mrs. Churchill rushed to find a doctor, Dr. Bowen arrived home across the street. His wife met him at the door, breathless, and told him to go to the Bordens immediately. He ran straight over, only to find there was nothing to be done. Dr. Bowen checked Andrew for a pulse, but there was none. He was gone. On the stand, Dr. Bowen recalled that someone asked about Abby's whereabouts and that Lizzie explained her stepmother received a note that morning to visit a sick friend. Calmly, Lizzie asked Dr. Bowen to send a telegram to her sister Emma so she'd be informed of what had happened. Bowen agreed and he left for the telegraph office. In the meantime, Alice Russell arrived to comfort her friend. Bridget, still shaken, was worried Abby didn't yet know what had happened to her husband. Lizzie heard this and perked up. She tells Bridget she was almost positive she'd heard her mother come in and asks her to go upstairs and check. Bridget refused to go alone, so Mrs. Churchill joined her. Together, they climbed the front staircase, and when Mrs. Churchill reached the landing, she froze. From there, She could see just enough of the guest room to make out a body on the floor, partly hidden by the bed. Abby Borden was face down in a pool of blood, struck down in the room her houseguest had left earlier that morning. Mrs. Churchill stepped into the room only for a moment before running back downstairs. Abby Borden was dead. Dr. Bowen returned shortly after and went upstairs. One touch told him Abby, like her husband, was dead. With both bodies discovered, the focus shifted. This was no longer a household in crisis. It was a crime scene. The investigation had begun. When officers stepped through the Borden doorway, they were struck by the silence. The first officer on scene, George Allen, came in through the kitchen door and found Lizzie standing near Mrs. Churchill. Calmly, almost matter-of-factly, Lizzie told him her father had been killed. Allen later recalled how composed she seemed. Not hysterical, not in shock, just calm. Too calm for a woman whose father and stepmother had just been slaughtered. And it wasn't just the police that noticed it. Bridget and Mrs. Churchill would also both testify that they never actually saw Lizzie cry. Something else they never saw? Signs of a break-in. Officer Patrick Doherty recalled the scene as too neat. Mr. Borden's body lay on the sofa, his boots still neatly on his feet, his gold watch still on him, pockets untouched, money undisturbed. They quickly ruled out a robbery gone wrong. Upstairs, when they discovered Abby's body, the picture became even clearer. The guest room showed no sign of a struggle. Abby had been struck from behind, face down, killed before she could even turn. Whoever had done it had known exactly when and how to attack. No overturned furniture, nothing missing, just two bodies brutally hacked to death inside a house locked tight from the inside. As the questions mounted, so did suspicion. It wasn't long before Lizzie's role shifted in the eyes of investigators, from grieving daughter to prime suspect. From the very beginning, investigators questioned Lizzie's story about the note. She told Dr. Bowen, Bridget, and neighbors that Abby had received a letter that morning summoning her to visit a sick friend. But when police scoured the house from top to bottom, there was nothing. No letter in the wastebaskets, no scraps in the fireplaces. They questioned the mail carriers. No delivery, no friend, no messenger, no note at all. To the police, it looked less like evidence and more like an excuse. And when they heard from Dr. Dolan, the medical examiner, their suspicions turned to certainty. Dr. Dolan testified that Abby Borden had been dead far longer than Andrew. Her blood was already congealed, her body noticeably cooler. In his words, she had been struck down first, likely while Andrew was still out of the house that morning. That detail was critical, and to the police, a chilling truth began to emerge. Abby was struck down first, 19 blows, savage and personal. Then, about an hour later, Andrew was attacked as he napped on the sofa. Two murders carried out in separate parts of a house locked tight from the outside world, and the only person unaccounted for during both windows of time was Lizzie Borden. The Commonwealth argued that Lizzie invented the story of the note and the sick friend on the spot, a convenient lie to cover why Abby wasn't seen in the house hours before Andrew's death. Because the truth was that she had been dead upstairs all along. Then came Lizzie's own words. The details she told police about where she'd been and when she'd been there shifted by the minute. She told one officer that she had been ironing handkerchiefs in the dining room before stepping out to the barn, and then claimed she spent half an hour up in the barn loft looking for lead sinkers for a fishing line before coming back inside to discover her father's body. But when investigators climbed into that loft themselves, her story didn't add up. A layer of dust covered the area, thick and undisturbed. There were no footprints, no sign that anyone had been there that morning. When Lizzie retold the story to other officers, her details shifted again. To some, she said that she had been upstairs when her father came home. Other times, she was in the kitchen. The length of time she claimed to be in the barn varied, too. Was it half an hour or just minutes? To the prosecution, these weren't innocent slips of memory. They were lies patched together to cover the gaps. Each new version clashed with the last. There were so many inconsistencies that eroded her credibility. The jury heard how Lizzie was the one person whose movements could not be pinned down with certainty during the moments when both Andrew and Abby were murdered. And the more she talked, the more her story unraveled. If the locked doors and Lizzie's shifting stories weren't enough, the Commonwealth had something else against Lizzie: her neighbors. One after another, Lizzie's neighbors took the stand. From breakfast until the moment the bodies were discovered, they said they never saw a stranger slip in or out of the Borden home. No suspicious figure on the street, no one darting through the yard, nothing out of the ordinary. The prosecution leaned heavily on this testimony. Fall River was a busy mill town, and Second Street, where the Bordens lived, was a well-traveled road where people noticed comings and goings. If an intruder had entered the Borden home in broad daylight, prosecutors insisted someone would have seen it, but no one did. The Commonwealth argued that the neighbor's testimony closed off the last escape in Lizzie's defense. But even as investigators built their case on locked doors, conflicting stories, and watchful neighbors, one piece of evidence would stand out above the rest. Days after the murders, with officers still searching for answers, Lizzie made a move that prosecutors said revealed everything. She burned a dress. It was Sunday morning, just 3 days after the murders, when Alice, Lizzie's closest friend, came to the Borden house to offer comfort. What she witnessed would instead become one of the prosecution's most powerful arguments. Alice testified that she walked into the kitchen and saw Emma standing at the sink and Lizzie standing at the cupboard with a light blue and pink dress in her hands. Lizzie looked over at Emma and told her she was going to destroy the dress because she claimed it was covered in paint. Before Alice could fully process what was happening, Lizzie began tearing the dress apart, feeding it piece by piece into the kitchen fire until it was gone. Alice said she was stunned. Investigators had been asking specifically about Lizzie's clothing in the days since the murders, what she had been wearing that morning, whether there had been blood on her dress. And now, here was Lizzie, in the middle of the investigation, burning one of her own. The timing was everything. If this really was just an old dress with paint stains, why destroy it now? But the prosecution argued that the dress wasn't stained with paint at all. It was stained with blood. They argued that Lizzie was careful and calculated and had kept it hidden until she could find the right time to destroy it. Prosecutor Moody told the jury that this single act spoke louder than all of Lizzie's shifting stories and the house's locked doors. Because in a case with no eyewitnesses and no confession, actions mattered. And Lizzie burning that dress, they argued, was the action of a guilty woman, erasing the most direct piece of evidence against her. The murders of Andrew and Abby Borden were carried out with brutal precision. 19 blows to Abby and at least 10 to Andrew. The weapon had to be small enough to swing in tight quarters, heavy enough to crush bone, and sharp enough to cut deep. So investigators went looking. In the cellar of the Borden house, they discovered a collection of hatchets and axes, ordinary household tools for the time. But one in particular stood out, a hatchet with its wooden handle broken off. To the prosecution, that break was no coincidence. They argued that the handle had been snapped deliberately to destroy the blood evidence that would have soaked into the wood. And the head of the hatchet, they claimed, bore the marks of a recent cleaning. The broken-handled hatchet became the centerpiece of the state's case. Officers testified it was found tucked away with other tools in the cellar, set apart just enough to draw suspicion. They paraded it before the jury, pointing out how its blade matched the size and shape of the wounds. And while there was debate of whether another hatchet in the house might have been the murder weapon, or whether the break in the handle could have been old, the Commonwealth insisted this was the weapon that took the lives of Abby and Andrew Borden. The deeper investigators dug, the smaller the target became. A hatchet head with a broken handle, a dress burned in the stove, the non-existent note, and all of the contradictions in Lizzie's story. The evidence seemed to eliminate every suspect but one. And that's when attention shifted to the question of why. Why would a woman of Lizzie's social standing, so devoted to her church and respected in her community, commit such an unspeakable crime? The answer, prosecutors argued, was written in years of tension and resentment. When police followed every lead, whether it was talk of poison, prowlers, or angry tenants, all roads, they said, led back to Lizzie Borden, beginning with a very unexpected source, Lizzie's closest friend, Alice Russell. Investigators didn't expect Alice Russell to play a pivotal role. She was simply there as a friend, sitting quietly in the Borden house while police questioned Lizzie. But as investigators pressed for details, Alice spoke up, urging Lizzie to repeat what she had told her the night before. Reluctantly, Lizzie did. She told them her father had enemies, that she feared someone might try to harm him, that their barn had been broken into, their house ransacked in daylight, and strange men had been hanging around at night. She even suggested the family's recent illness might be from poisoned milk. It was a story that, on the surface, cast suspicion outward. When police began checking, those claims unraveled and led back to Lizzie. They learned that just one day before the murders, Lizzie walked into a drugstore and tried to buy prussic acid, one of the deadliest poisons available, claiming she needed it to clean a sealskin cape. The pharmacist refused, but with the whole family sick just days before the murders, investigators now wondered, was it really enemies Lizzie was worried about, or her own actions? Family physician Dr. Bowen's testimony made those suspicions even stronger. He recalled that Lizzie had been the one to raise the idea of poison when her family fell ill, telling him her father had enemies. To the Commonwealth, this wasn't the worry of a fearful daughter. It was groundwork for a cover story, a way to plant the idea of outside threats before the murders even occurred. The more investigators dug into what Lizzie had told Alice Russell the night before the murders, the more suspicious it became. Prosecutors would later argue, how could Lizzie possibly have predicted impending doom mere hours before it happened? To them, it wasn't foresight. It was foreshadowing. A story being built in advance. But why would she do this? Investigators didn't have to wait long for a clue. During early questioning, an officer asked Lizzie who could have done such a thing to her father and mother. Her response was sharp. She is not my mother. She is my stepmother. My mother is dead. That was more than a correction. It was a glimpse beyond the family's polished facade and a window into the bitterness inside the Borden home. Behind the Borden's church-going respectability and wealth was a house divided, one that may have harbored resentments strong enough to commit murder. In his opening statement, prosecutor William Moody told jurors that the relationship between Lizzie and her stepmother had never been cordial, and in later years had grown into positive dislike. He promised to show them that resentment had become the air inside that house, and it was so heavy, it could suffocate. The prosecution pointed to years of tension, sometimes quiet, sometimes openly hostile. Friends and acquaintances testified about the strained relationship between Lizzie and her stepmother, and prosecutor Moody pointed to a conflict from 5 years earlier as the source. Andrew Borden, wealthy but famously frugal, deeded a house to Abby's relatives. To Abby, it was security, but to Emma and Lizzie, it was betrayal. They believed their father's estate was slipping away into the hands of a woman they already resented. Prosecutors told the jury this decision deepened a divide that had already been widening for years. Moody said up to that point, Lizzie had referred to Abby as mother, but after the property controversy, she began calling her only Mrs. Borden. A dressmaker took the stand and told the jury about a time only months before the murders when she referred to Mrs. Borden as Lizzie's mother. She said Lizzie snapped, telling her, "Don't call her mother. She is a mean thing and we hate her. We have as little to do with her as possible." Lizzie went on to explain to the dressmaker that she and Emma often kept to themselves upstairs. They stayed in their rooms as much as possible. And when it came to mealtimes, Lizzie admitted she usually waited until Abby and her father were finished before coming down to eat. To prosecutors, this exchange wasn't just a polite correction on what to call Mrs. Borden. It was a revelation. They said it showed deliberate distance, a wall that Lizzie insisted on keeping between her and her stepmother. In the prosecution's eyes, it was one of the rare moments when Lizzie's composure cracked and showed what was beneath: resentment. Moody told jurors Abby was not collateral damage. She was, quote, the first object of Lizzie's hate. When it came time for closing arguments, District Attorney Knowlton didn't mince words. He told the jurors this case wasn't built on one piece of evidence, but on a chain of circumstances, links that, when joined together, pointed to one inescapable conclusion. The locks on the doors sealed tight to the outside world. A note that never existed. The barn loft undisturbed. The dress burned. The hatchet with its handle snapped off. Each piece on its own, perhaps, explainable. But together, the prosecution argued, they formed a chain too strong to break. For the motive, prosecutors reminded the jury of Lizzie's own words, "She is not my mother." They reminded them of the property conflict and the resentment that had festered for years. They pointed to the 19 blows to the back of Abby's head as proof she was the first object of Lizzie's hate, and to Andrew's mutilated face as evidence that this wasn't a crime of chance, but one of design. The prosecution told jurors not to be distracted by Lizzie's reputation, her church work, or her calm demeanor. "It is not what people seem to be in public," he argued. "It is what they are in their own household under their own roof." In the end, Knowlton's argument was simple. Two people were murdered inside a locked home, and every person was accounted for, except one. "You are asked to believe," he said, "not that some strange assassin crept in and out like a phantom, but that the hand which struck was the one within." The prosecution's story was set. To them, Lizzie Borden was not the respectable daughter the public thought they knew. She was a cold-blooded killer. They left it to 12 men in the jury box to decide whether the chain of circumstances laid before them was enough to condemn her. But before that decision could be made, the defense had a story to tell. A story built not on guilt, but on doubt. They argued the evidence was weak and the timeline improbable. They were about to introduce a shocking twist, one that has kept the world debating more than a century later. Were police so focused on Lizzie that they ignored what was right in front of them? That someone else may have been lurking outside the Borden home that morning? Tune in next week for new witnesses, new testimony, and a story that turns everything upside down.